Hello, I'm Lina Hudu. Welcome to Health Chat. Around the world, frontline workers such as doctors, medical specialists, and other healthcare support providers are the backbone of the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic. Faced with long hours and overwhelmed health systems, their resilience and dedication is critical in caring for the high number of patients infected with coronavirus. I spoke to one frontline worker, Dr. Linda Mubula, assistant professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and an emergency physician volunteer with Samaritan's Purse in New York City. She shares her experience of providing care for patients during the COVID-19 outbreak in New York and lessons learned from Africa. Take a listen.
Dr. Linda Mubula, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You are in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic as a health provider. Can you give us a sense of what is happening now?
New York City remains the epicenter of the COVID-19 outbreak in the United States. It has more than 300,000 cases. And we have seen a steady decline in the number of admissions that we're getting, as well as in the number of cases. The New York City healthcare system was quite overwhelmed with this pandemic. There was limited bed capacity. Physicians, nurses, healthcare providers were quite overwhelmed with the number of cases that were being admitted. And things are getting better, which is the good news, but I think there still needs to be a lot of vigilance regarding a potential spike or second wave. I think it's important to maintain social distancing measures, but also just to be sure that people stay at home so that we don't see another increase in the number of cases.
You mentioned social distancing measures. In the United States, we see that some states are opening. Are we where we're supposed to be when we look at the big picture?
There is a potential for a surge in the number of cases as people start going out and as states start to reopen. I do understand the importance, though, of states reopening in the sense that people need to work. They have there's a need for them to actually make money. And I do understand that. However, I think there's a big risk here that we have to consider. If we're not accompanying the reopening of states with provision of masks and protection of essential workers, I think there's a big danger that people will get reinfected. In fact, many of the patients that I saw were essential workers. They were Uber drivers. They were taxi drivers. Another man worked as a doorbell man. And so we're seeing many cases coming from individuals that are exposed to those that have COVID-19. And so there is a risk that there will be a spike in the number of cases as states reopen. So I think we have to look at this with a lot of caution. But as I said, we need to provide protective measures for essential workers, for individuals that will be working, but also make sure that hospitals are well equipped for a surge, meaning they need to have enough beds, they need to have enough PPE, personal protective equipment, as well as infection control measures that need to be put into place. With every emergency, and when you see a surge in the number of cases, you have to prepare yourself. And I think the US healthcare system has to prepare for a surge by putting into place these really important measures.
When you look at the way the pandemic has swept through New York City and the devastation it has caused, what do you find more surprising?
I think, for one, I'm going to give you a short story. There's a woman that approached a colleague and I the other day saying this reminded her of 9/11. And New York City in 2001 went through this horrible tragedy where there were many lives that were lost. And once again, New York City is experiencing a tragedy where many, many lives are lost. And to an extent, that's much greater, to a scale that's much greater than what happened during 9/11. And I think mental health is gonna be really important to address. Among COVID-19 survivors, being isolated, having lost their own family members and friends, I think that's something we need to address very early on. There was a patient that we cared for who had lost many of her church members, who had lost a spouse. And I think the impact of the loss of human life is going to be great, not just in terms of looking at numbers. We need to think of these individuals as people, as human beings who've lost family members. And that's something that's going to be that's going to need to be addressed long term. In addition to that, of course, I think strengthening health systems. I think what this pandemic has showed us is that that every health system is susceptible to a large-scale outbreak, and you need to put into place preparedness measures for the next one, because there will be another pandemic or there will be another wave, and so we need to be prepared for that.
It's amazing to see that a health system such as the United States, one of the tops in the world, is overwhelmed with a pandemic such as this. Does this mean that there's never enough preparedness?
So every healthcare system in the world is vulnerable to an overwhelming number of cases from an infectious disease outbreak. And so I've seen this in DRC with Ebola. I've seen this in West Africa and Haiti with the cholera outbreak. There are basic preparedness measures that you can put into place, understanding how to mitigate, for example, putting into place a system to increase bed capacity, training your healthcare providers, having extra stock of personal protective equipment, just in case there is a surge. I think the important lesson learned here is that we need to be prepared at all times by having basic things in place. And these are the things that I had mentioned.
When we think about preparedness, we think about low and middle income countries. It's more or less obvious, right? But now with what we are witnessing, what does preparedness look like? Is it different? Is it the same, just increased capacity? What is it?
So I think having a contingency plan, number one, for a surge of cases. So bed capacity is one thing, making sure that you're able to expand by increasing the number of beds. Having a pool of healthcare providers that can respond, having equipment, having supplies in place. And I think the difference, as you mentioned, with low and middle income countries is that we do have the resources, financial resources in the United States to put that into place. I think some of these countries that I've worked in typically don't have those resources. And it's more difficult then to be able to scale up a response without having additional help from donors, for example. There are multiple donors that end up providing support, financial support, to these countries. In addition to financial support, there's technical capacity. You have to be able to train healthcare providers to respond. And I think one of the potential weaknesses here is that not everybody is trained in public health. Not all clinicians are trained in public health. So I think actually incorporating public health training in medical schools is going to be really important as well here in the U.S.
How do we determine that a city, a country has gone through its peak? And if I may take you to Africa, for example, because you also work in Africa. So can you talk to us about what we're looking forward to with regards to Africa, for example?
So I think widespread testing. In order to be able to detect every case. If you're not testing, if you're not doing proper surveillance, if you're not doing proper contact tracing, you don't know if you've actually detected every single case. And I think in the U.S., as in other countries, we need to scale up testing. We need to make sure that we're doing proper contact tracing. We have good surveillance in place. So COVID-19 is somewhat different from Ebola in that it's spread by respiratory droplets. But in the case of Ebola, for example, there was a great system in DRC whereby epidemiologists would do door-to-door case finding, and they would look for cases. And I think in this case, as long as we're not identifying contacts of cases and isolating them appropriately, we won't know. So this is why I really want to emphasize the need for very strong surveillance systems and increasing the scale of testing.
Are tests available when they are needed?
There has been an increase in the availability of tests, which is great. I think we do need to test more. When you walk around New York City, there are multiple signs with phone numbers of places where you can actually get tests done. And I think New York City has done an incredible job with the number of people they have tested. And as you know, there's a hypothesis that there is asymptomatic transmission, meaning people that don't have symptoms are still able to transmit the disease, which is why it's important to test and isolate.
What do you see as the lessons learned from New York City, although the pandemic is still ongoing, but what would you say would be some of the takeaways that perhaps low and middle income countries in Africa can learn from and perhaps can either avoid or replicate?
I think it's important to have a very strong leader who is really involved in the response. And this goes with coordination of a response, whether it's at state level, at the federal level. I think there are also lessons learned that countries like the U.S. Need to learn from Africa as well, for example, with Ebola. So it does go both ways.
Yes.
Community engagement, I think, is really, really, really important. And risk communication. When you go to Times Square, for example, you see billboards everywhere that talk about coronavirus and COVID-19, encouraging the community to stay at home, to wear masks, to wash their hands. I think New York City has done an amazing job with risk communication, but also involvement of community leaders. So this is something that's really important that I've seen here in New York City, but I've seen this in DRC, for example, with Ebola. As the response progressed, there was more involvement of religious leaders, of traditional leaders, of community leaders. And I think that's really key. You can't get your community to be involved unless you have strong risk communication and community engagement. I think listening to the community is extremely important. In DRC, there's a system that was created whereby the community could provide feedback to responders. If you're not listening to the community and just having this one-sided, I'm telling you what to do, your response is not going to be effective. And so I think there are lessons learned from New York City, but also from low and middle income countries that we can look upon and leverage.
What is your take on the impact that this is having on your colleagues, on you, and how do you personally handle this?
It's exhausting, I think, to work on this response. Wearing PPE for several hours takes a toll. My colleagues and I have worked 100 hours a week for the past several weeks, and fatigue is something that comes up. Fear, I think, as well. I think we have to acknowledge that, the fear of becoming infected. But also, I think it does have an effect on one's mental health, as indicated by the suicide of our dear colleague that just took her life. And I think it's important to encourage healthcare providers. Every day in New York City at 7 p.m., everybody claps for healthcare providers. There's been overwhelming support for healthcare providers. And I think we need to continue doing that, not just now, but once the outbreak is over, once the pandemic is over, to continue to provide that support, because we all need it. There are healthcare providers that are separated from their families and that have been separated for a long time. And usually when you're going through a crisis, your family's around to support you. And when you don't have that, I think that does take a toll. You know, the isolation, the long hours, the number of deaths, the number of cases that we're seeing have all affected healthcare providers. So I encourage everyone to continue to provide support to all healthcare workers, because they are, in fact, heroes.
They are heroes. And this is a word that we see now that is being used to call healthcare workers heroes. And you mentioned how people are clapping at 7 p.m. to encourage you. Beyond this, beyond the clapping, the cheering, the heroes calling, what else can make your work easier at this point?
Ensuring that there is that support that is provided to healthcare providers in terms of, you know, personal protective equipment, just equipment, but also making sure that staffing is adequate for all these healthcare providers who are working on long hours.
So you are originally from the continent of Africa. You've worked on the continent. Today we're seeing that although the outbreak is on the continent, Africa remains the region with less cases compared to the rest of the world. What do you make of this, and what are your thoughts on what is happening right now with the COVID-19 pandemic in Africa?
Just because Africa doesn't have as many cases as Europe or the United States does not mean that in the future it won't. And I think there's definitely a risk that Africa could become the next epicenter. And we're seeing an exponential rise in the number of COVID-19 cases in Africa, with South Africa having the highest number of cases. So I think we need to, again, be very cautious about the prevalence of COVID-19. There could be it could be that we're not testing enough people. So we need to increase the number of tests that we're doing. We need to be able to detect cases much, much better than we are right now. I think mitigation measures are really important. Social distancing, I think, in Africa, and lockdown, I think, are two concepts that will look different. In Africa, you cannot ask people to stay at home for weeks and weeks without providing them with food. So food security is going to be something that we need to look at differently in low and middle income countries, specifically on the African continent. And there have been multiple people that I've written that have been thinking about how to adapt strategies in Africa. Because these same strategies, the same interventions that might work in one country might not necessarily work in Africa. So providing that additional support, and I focus on food security a lot because I think it's going to be extremely important to provide support, that type of support to families if you're asking them to stay at home.
Food security, how do we ensure that today?
I think food distributions, there are many organizations that routinely do food distributions in countries that have issues with food insecurity. So this is something we did during the West Africa Ebola outbreak. We also did this in DRC. So contacts of confirmed cases would actually receive a food package. They would receive rice, beans, and et cetera. So there would be a package that was actually distributed to families to ensure that they stayed at home. So I think this is going to be extremely critical and central to the response to COVID-19 in African countries, especially those that are experiencing food insecurity.
And talk to us briefly about your work with Samaritan Purse.
So I deployed as a volunteer with Samaritan's Purse in New York City, and the field hospital opened on April 1st and treated about 188 plus patients. And this was in partnership with Mount Sinai Hospital. And the hospital received patients from various emergency rooms in New York City, from Queens, from Brooklyn, all over the city. And the majority of patients were men, about 68% men, 32% female, all socioeconomic backgrounds, all ethnicities, all faiths. And so the number of cases has gone down, as I had mentioned earlier. And I think personally, it's been such a rewarding experience to be able to care for COVID-19 patients during this crisis. We were able to celebrate birthdays in the hot zone with certain patients. We became almost like family members to them because they were in isolation, had to call their families every day to provide them with updates. And interestingly enough, a patient told me, I couldn't see your face and I couldn't see you smiling, but I could see you smiling through your eyes. Wearing personal protective equipment is challenging for the patient and for a clinician because you want to be able to show empathy to your patients and compassion. And it's difficult to do when they can only see your eyes and they don't know what you look like. And so sometimes we had to hold our patients' hands. Sometimes we just had to smile with their eyes and try to show compassion in any way we could.
Before we wrap, do you have a message that you'd like to share?
I think we should all take this pandemic seriously. I want to say that COVID-19 is not like the flu, and I've seen pretty critical patients. Let us all come together to flatten the curve in whatever capacity we can. As clinicians, as public health providers, as politicians, as leaders, let's all come together to ensure that we flatten this curve and end this outbreak.
Dr. Mubula, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We thank our guest, Dr. Linda Mubula, emergency physician volunteer with Samaritan's Purse, who is currently working on the front line of the COVID-19 pandemic in New York City. Now, the coronavirus has hit South Africa harder than any other country on the continent. So far, it has infected more than 22,000 people and killed over 400. But the disease is also impacting the mental well-being of many people coping with social isolation and the economic impact of the virus. Franco Puglisi reports for VOA News in Johannesburg, South Africa.
As COVID-19 ramps up in South Africa, hospitals are seeing more patients suspected of having the virus, but the pandemic is also causing an increase in the number of mental health-related problems due to the pandemic.
While clinics and hospitals are open, very few of them still pay attention to current mental health care users during this time. And also, there is no screening for mental health during COVID-19 screening and testing.
Experts warn the nation's health care system is underfunded.
Now we are in the pandemic and you're finding yourself sort of on the back foot with an already fragile system and not knowing how to go about fixing it. But knowing this, knowing that, you know, it is a poorly resourced, poorly distributed system.
Critics say only few can get the mental health care they need due to the lack of resources.
In South Africa, only 5% of the national budgets, of the national health budget, goes towards mental health services.
Experts say the global pandemic has left many unsure about what lies ahead.
There's all this anxiety around unknown factors that's out of our control. People will often catastrophize and imagine the worst possible outcome.
Wendy Jones, an anxiety sufferer, says she needs mental health assistance.
I personally feel more anxious, I get really worried, and who do I go to? Am I on the right medication? Should my medication be increased? I don't know these things. I need somebody to tell me. Your trust in the medical system as it is should be complete. It should be absolute, but it isn't.
South Africa has been through similar health crises before, and studies show the impact is lasting.
There will be some long-lasting effects on the psyche and the mental health state of the population, based on what has happened before. We've had SARS, we've had MERS, we've had Ebola, and all of these have required some sort of lockdown or some sort of quarantine to take place. And studies emerging from that have found out that this has had a detrimental impact on people's mental health state.
Experts say they worry this time the mental health care system will not be able to meet the demand in months to come. Franco Puclisi for VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
In Ghana, the COVID-19 pandemic has spurred health technology innovations, from applications to track symptoms in workplaces to online diagnosis and drone delivery of test samples. As confirmed infections continue to rise in Ghana, reaching more than 6,000 cases and over 30 deaths, health tech experts want to ensure people have access to needed medicines and doctors. Stacey Knott reports from Ghana.
Ghana's healthcare technology companies like Redbird are creating innovations in response to the coronavirus pandemic. Redbird already had a system that helps users diagnose and monitor chronic and tropical diseases. Now, the company has added a function that helps people diagnose whether they have COVID-19. Users can input symptoms into an app and keep track of their movements to determine if they have been in contact with a confirmed case.
Organizations are going to have to come back to work, right? And you're going to have to find a safe way of coming back to work, right? Not every organization can work remotely. So this is something that is moving ahead and helping organizations to sort of like plan this and be able to say, okay, I know my people, okay, we're going to be back in 2 weeks. I want to know everyone, like who's been in touch with a COVID patient. Like, okay, you don't need to come. Like, let's not risk it for the other people.
With a shortage of healthcare facilities across Ghana, and to encourage social distancing, Ghana's doctors have looked to technology to consult patients remotely.
When the pandemic started, I noticed that most of the people were scared to come to the clinics and the hospitals because they thought that they were going to get the infection from there. So then Talamus reached out to me, and they were like, how about we take this opportunity to use telemedicine as a form to reach our patients.
Talamus Ghana's Joshua Owusu-Ansa says COVID-19 has underscored the need to utilise technology for healthcare.
I think it's going to be an eye-opener to show Ghanaians and Africans especially that there's less stressful ways of doing things, right? Because to get a lot of things done in Ghana and Africa is really, really hard because a lot of our systems are just kept manual. So this is one of the eye-openers that's going to show us that we need to do some things using technology. We need to leverage technology to do some things.
Perhaps the most famous example of healthcare tech in Ghana is the Silicon Valley company Zipline's use of drones to transport medicine and blood samples. With the coronavirus, drones have been carrying samples from suspected COVID-19 patients to laboratories in big cities to speed up diagnosis and help better track the pandemic. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
Kenya has stepped up efforts to find a local treatment for COVID-19. The Kenya Medical Research Institute, KEMRI, East Africa's leading medical research facility, is testing the efficacy of an herbal medicine known as Zedupex. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
The search for both a cure and a vaccine for the coronavirus has intensified around the globe, including in Kenya, as medical researchers race to find the elusive remedy. Dr. Festus Tolo of Kenya's Medical Research Institute is taking the lead in finding out whether a herbal-based drug will be effective against COVID-19. Zedupex, developed in 2015 by Kenyan researchers, has been used in the treatment of herpes. Dr. Tolo says his team does not know yet whether the drug will work against the virus.
We have started looking at the clinical efficacy of this product. We are still on very early stages. We cannot be able to really say, knowing that the herpes simplex virus is a DNA virus and the coronavirus is an RNA virus. This really means that we need to, first of all, confirm, check whether there is activity before we can be able to really say this is a product which we can explore further for COVID management.
Rudy Eggers is with the World Health Organization. Eggers says that standardizing the various herbal cures could be quite a challenge.
In other medicine, we find that there are very specific levels of the active ingredient in it. And in herbal cures, frequently you find very varied components and then also levels of those components in there. So in fact, you would have to standardize these cures to make sure that you know what is in them and what component is actually acting. So that's quite a step to be taken before you can really evaluate these cures.
Dr. Kefa Bosire, who is at the University of Nairobi, also has reservations about traditional cures, saying that mass production could be an issue.
The immediate challenge we would face is getting sufficient quantities of the plant so that we can prepare them to supply the number of patients that may require it on a short notice, like we have experienced during this pandemic. And so this would require a lot of work to go into identifying the best way to upscale the growing and the collection of these materials.
Despite these hurdles, researchers at KEMRI are pressing ahead with their study of herbal treatments for COVID-19. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's our show for today. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out on facebook.com/voahealthchat. I'm your host, Lynn Ormudu in Washington with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, be well, be safe and wash your hands more often and strive to make every day a healthy day.
This is the